Today's Between the Rows podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Gowan Canada, the go-to company. Gowan's herbicide portfolio includes Avidex and Fortress, which control Group 1 and Group 2 resistant wild oats. Don't let wild oats rob your yields. Use Avidex and Fortress to stop them in their tracks. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator looks at how environmentalists and cattle producers are teaming up to save native grasslands in Manitoba.
Cow-calf producers in Manitoba are actually the single largest conservation group in this province, and conservation groups recognize that.
The Western producer's Robin Booker highlights one producer who's having success with intercropping.
You'll have more red lentils on the top of hills and more peas at the bottom and in the low spots. So, and he says with that, he's able to greatly boost his yield.
And Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada takes a look at the markets.
Soybean crop in South America is definitely front and center. It's a bearish force for canola. Both Argentina and Brazil have massive crops. As well, there's still the question how much canola is left in Alberta and Saskatchewan. It's probably not going to be great quality.
All this on Between the Rows with this week's host, Robert Arneson.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Robert Arneson of The Western Producer. First up on the program today, Manitoba cattle producers and a conservation group are teaming up on a new program to protect grassland birds. Lorraine Stevenson, a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator, joins me now to talk about it. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi, Robert.
So, can you tell me what this program is all about?
Sure. Manitoba beef producers are taking the lead on a new program. The aim is to work with beef producers in targeted areas of southwestern Manitoba, where cattle producers still maintain substantial tracts of grassland area. The program is going to offer producers who wish to participate incentives to undertake practices related to grazing and feeding to enhance their pasture's productive value. And at the same time, the aim is to make it optimum habitat for threatened birds. We're talking about bird species like the little bird sparrow and the burrowing owl. These, of course, are birds that can only survive on grassland.
So who's providing the money for this program?
The money was announced last week. It is a federal initiative called Environment and Climate Changes Species at Risk Partnerships on Agricultural Lands. That's quite a mouthful. SARPOL is the acronym. Again, it's an entirely voluntary program for cattle producers. Manitoba beef producers will contract field staff with Manitoba Habitat Heritage Corporation to work with the producers who want to take part.
So why is this partnership happening? Why are conservation groups supporting ranchers in this way?
Well, it's because cow-calf producers in Manitoba are actually the single largest conservation group in this province, and conservation groups recognize that. More habitat for these threatened birds is maintained by these producers than anyone or anywhere else. The producers are the critical link to save these birds. If we didn't have these cattle producers, we'd have even less than the tiny fraction of grasslands we have left. As Christian Artuzo, Manitoba Program Manager for Bird Studies Canada, said last week, cattle producers are these birds' last hope.
The prairie has been, the grassland ecosystem of the Great Plains, the prairie, has been carved up. There's not much of it left, to be honest. Depending on whether you're talking about tall grass, mixed grass, or short grass, it's all less than 10% of its former extent. A lot of that is on private lands. A lot of that is in beef production. A lot of that is cattle ranches. And that's all the grass we have left. And it's, you know, there's a lot of market pressure on those producers now to change into other times? I'm sure you know that better than me, just how many reasons they might have to sell up. And if they do, then that pasture becomes something else. Then we will lose that grass, and if we lose that grass, we lose those birds. And those birds, some of them have already lost 90% of their populations. We cannot afford to lose any more prairie.
So I guess I'm wondering, obviously this program is going to help the birds, but how will this program benefit the cattle producers themselves?
Yeah, it'll help ranchers in a number of ways, Robert. As you said in your intro, the goal here is to keep cattle producers in business. So improved grazing means better grass, which of course is good for cattle and the bottom line of the farm. The Manitoba Habitat Heritage Corporation field staff will be talking to producers about what will make sense for their operation. So there's lots of consultation involved. The focus is mainly on things like establishing additional fencing for rotational grazing systems, possibly watering systems that can help to distribute grazing pressure, establishing complementary pastures to help reduce pressure on existing pasture land. An important one is undertaking activities to control expansion of woody plant species like the wolf willow, which invade pasture when we don't have fire on the prairies anymore. And encroachment of these kinds of plants isn't good for producers, and it's not good for grassland birds either. The program offers cost-shared incentives for producers who want to participate, with funding available to them to a maximum of $10,000 per quarter section or $50,000 per landowner. The entire program has $750,000 in it.
Okay, so there's benefits for the grassland birds and benefits for the farmers, the cattle producers. What else will this do for the environment?
Well, sounds like a lot of money, and the funds going into this are substantial, but it's recognized that not only the birds and the ranchers benefit from the protection of, the establishment of, the enhancement of perennial grasslands. There's a host of environmental goods and services that come from that. Here's what Tim Sopuck, CEO with Manitoba Habitat Heritage Corporation, had to say about that.
I really believe that the conservation community has come down squarely on, wait a minute, this industry is of strategic importance, and the more that we do to help this industry grow, the better, the more habitat we'll have. We recognize, for example, in Manitoba, the single largest conservation group in this province is our assemblage of cow-calf producers. There is more habitat being maintained by cow-calf producers in the agricultural landscape than any other group in this province. So more and more we are asking the question, actually to the industry and also of ourselves, how can we help you grow your industry? Because cattle and cattle producers are absolutely fundamental and fundamentally important to habitat conservation and many other linked environmental outcomes. If we want to sort of manage our floodwaters better, we need perennial cover, we need wetlands, we need woodlands, and you tend to be able to conserve those areas more effectively with cattle production.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the good things about this program, but my experience with ranchers is that they're sometimes suspicious of environmental programs. How are cattlemen responding to this program so far?
Well, you're quite right, Robert. Conservation efforts have had a pretty rough ride in the agricultural community, and it's because people see them, have seen them at least, as a threat to their ability to do business. But Brian Lemon, the general manager of Manitoba Beef Producers, says this program is different. He says this is not about choosing one over the other.
Grassland is a helpful thing. And so having grass and pasture helps with water management and the movement of water across the landscape, helps with biodiversity, helps with all these environmental objectives that society is looking for, and we're part of the solution. So I don't know that we've ever been sort of not engaged in this initiative, but this is recognition that of the good work we've been doing all along.
Well, great, Lorraine. Thanks for coming on the show to talk about this.
You're welcome.
You can read more about this story in this week's issue of the Manitoba Cooperator or on their website. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Robert Arneson. Coming up a little later on the program, David Sims of Commodity News Service will join us for a look at markets. But first, on the line from Saskatoon, the Western producer's Robin Booker. Hi, Robin.
How's it going, Robert?
Good, good. So as you know, Robin, most Canadian farmers seed several crops every spring, but they only plant one type of crop per field. You recently wrote a piece about a farmer who seeds several crops into the same field. Can you tell us more about him and what he's doing?
Sure, Robert. So I attended the Sask Soil Conservation Association conference in Saskatoon, and there was a producer panel. And on the panel was Colin Rosengren, who farms in Mydale, Saskatchewan. And he's been intercropping down there, or experimenting, since 2004. So he described his operation and kind of how it's evolved and just some of his experience with intercropping.
So for people who don't know what intercropping is, can you kind of explain that in a bit more detail? Like, are you planting two crops or three crops or five crops in the same field? What does it look like?
Well, intercropping is, you know, growing two or more crops at the same time on a field. So, I mean, with forages, you'll often see pasture mixes or whatnot. But here, we're talking cash crops. So, you know, he's growing and then separating these crops and selling them as a commodity.
So what would be a typical mixture of crops on his farm?
With intercropping, there's all kinds of different mixtures out there. It kind of just depends on the grower's needs and abilities, I guess. What he's come to now, what I thought was most interesting, was this canola, red lentil, and pea mixture that he's growing at the same time.
So I guess, you know, I'm more familiar with people growing one crop at a time. This sounds kind of complicated. Why would he do something like this?
At the end of the day, he said it's more profitable. He's able to grow more on fewer acres, and he says it helps reduce his input costs. And, you know, once he figured out the logistics, it actually isn't too bad. He's able to handle it quite well, he said.
So what are some of the logistic challenges? Is it harvest? Is that the biggest challenge, separating the seed?
I don't think harvest would be, from what he was saying. He said, like, seeding, you know, like, just the logistics of bringing all these different products, all these different seeds, you know, bringing it out to the drill and keeping the drill moving. Because if you think of it, you have, you know, multiple crops, say two or three seeds, and, you know, he wants to do everything with one pass, of course. So you have three different products there, and then you have different fertilizers. So, you know, just keeping the drill moving, I think, would be the hardest.
So this is a topic at the Saskatchewan Soil Conservation Association meeting. So how does this sort of practice, intercropping, benefit the soil?
So a big thing for helping build soil, according to Colin, is, you know, maintaining diversity or bolstering diversity. So with these intercrops, you're able to have just a different soil sort of root structures these plants are have, and you have, you know, different ability to draw in different beneficial insects, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what some of the benefits of it is.
So I did a story about Colin and intercropping about 6 years ago. Has he changed how he does things? Has it evolved on his farm?
Yeah, with the canola, red lentil, pea mixture, one of the things that he's doing now is he's having variable rate. So in nature, if you just look at a field, like you'll notice that different plants are successful in different areas in the field. So, like, in the low spots, will be populated, you know, by like natural areas by different plants compared to the high spots. So what he's trying to do is mimic that. So with his canola red lentil pea, he'll bias, like, he'll have more red lentils on the top of hills and more peas at the bottom and in the low spots. So, and he says with that, he's able to greatly boost his yield.
Hmm. So, you know, when I drive around the countryside, I don't see a lot of, you know, evidence of intercropping. What's your sense of this? Is this practice catching on at all?
You know, here in Canada, I don't see a lot of it either. But my understanding is down in the States, it is sort of catching on a lot more. You know, of course, they have a longer growing season. But down in the States, you'll see, like, with the winter wheat crop, there are some growers going in, you know, say in May before it canopies, and they'll be planting some soy. So once the wheat is taken off, you know, combined, the soy is already well established and kind of takes over the field. So I think down in the States, it's becoming more common. Here in Canada, in the prairies, I don't think it's a really common practice yet, Robert.
Okay. But it's something that, you know, potentially might catch on in the future. That's the hope anyway.
I think so. There are definite benefits to it, and it seems like it can be profitable just by looking at Colin Rosengren's experience. So I know right now online the story is generating a lot of interest, so we'll see, maybe in a few years.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Robin, to talk about this. Robin Booker writes for The Western Producer. He joined me today from Saskatoon. You can read this article in The Western Producer or online at their website. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Robert Arneson of The Western Producer. Now here with a look at the markets, Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
So March opened with a market rally, thanks to rumors around biofuels. Can you tell us more about these rumors, and will this have any kind of longer-term impact on canola prices and commodity prices in Canada?
Yeah, I think that's what everyone's wondering right now. Like, we definitely had a pretty good two-day rally there. The May contract, which is the dominant one, gained about $18 over those 2 days. And I'm not really sure who got the ball rolling, but the speculation started pretty early that the president, Donald Trump, was going to roll out incentives for ethanol and biofuel during his address to Congress. Now, obviously, that didn't happen, but it certainly got the markets churning. And also, there were rumors or ideas that Brazilian biodiesel imports into the U.S. were going to be slashed. Now, so far, there haven't been any concrete details about whether or not that's going to happen. But I think Donald Trump's buy American, use American mantra has many convinced that something is going to come out here sooner rather than later.
So just so I'm clear on this, the rumor was around restrictions on imports of biofuels, or was there more to this?
Well, there was rumors that incentives for U.S. ethanol and U.S. biodiesel production was going to be coming out, and that falls in line with Trump's, you know, America first mantra. But there was also some ideas that imports of Brazilian biodiesel into the U.S. was going to be slashed. And so far we haven't seen anything, but there are other ideas too, but those were some of the main ones.
Has that rally lasted into this further into the month at all, or where are we at since that initial rally?
Well, funny you should mention that. We're down $8 today, but the rally had a lingering effect for, I would say, a few days past the initial two-day rally. Now, canola has some technical support, like the 200-day moving average for the May contract is at $508, so I think it would take some significant news to drop below that. We're still at $523 right now, and there's other factors that are helping support canola. So it's got some room to move either way, but we've certainly come off the highs of that rally now.
So what are those other factors that you're watching in terms of what could move canola over the next 30 days or so?
Well, the soybean crop in South America is definitely front and center. It's a bearish force for canola. Both Argentina and Brazil have massive crops. As well, there's still the question how much canola is left in Alberta and Saskatchewan. It's probably not going to be great quality, but the uncertainty is a bit of a problem. Palm oil is another issue. World production is expected to hit 65 million tons this year. That is up substantially from 58 million last year. Farmer hedging has come in. And one other thing to consider, too, of course, you know, is the chance for flooding, eastern Saskatchewan, western Manitoba. We know it's going to be wet already, but all we need is a few big dumps of snow, and I think it's going to be a new ball game for everyone. One good news, I guess, for farmers, or I guess some of the bigger companies, is the crush margins have actually climbed a few bucks in the past week. And that's something we haven't said for a while. Like, the May contract on the crush index was up to $95 per ton yesterday when it was just $80 a week ago. So the crush pace is still very high. And the decline helped. We were down a cent and a half over the past 8-9 days, and that is pretty significant over the course of a week or so. So obviously that decline makes canola a little more attractive to international buyers.
Is the sentiment in the market that the Canadian dollar could fall further? Is that what people are thinking, or what's the mood right now around the loonie?
Well, there seems to be some ideas that could happen. I think people are still catching their breath trying to determine what Janet Yellen's speech meant the other day when she was saying the U.S. Fed would hike their interest rates. So I think that's thrown a few uncertainties out there. So I think maybe in the next week we'll get a better idea of where the loonie is going to go.
Okay. So shifting to livestock, what's been happening with cattle prices in early March?
Well, cattle prices actually ticked up a bit over the past week as we saw some U.S. buyers come up for cattle. That's a change over the past few weeks when it was mainly Ontario leading the charge, because during, I think, the first few months of 2017, cattle buyers in Nebraska and Kansas and some of the bigger volume states could pretty much get their animals for the same price locally as they could up here, so a lot of them were just staying home. But as I mentioned before, the decline of the dollar and a rise in futures prices on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange prompted some of them to come up last week and take a look around. So Ontario is still buying, though, but the sort of reintroduction of U.S. buyers to the market has been really good news.
So overall, you know, it's been sort of a rough year over the last 12 months for the cattle market. Is there a sense that things are turning around, or what's your sense of where things are at now?
Well, there still seems to be some caution in the market. I've talked to two or three different participants who have told me that. And like forward contracting, you can still get forward contracts out there, but there's nothing great right now. Like, it's hard to make a lot of money on forward contracts. And the slaughter in Ontario wasn't running at full capacity last week. So there's maybe a few ideas. Demand from the east could soften a bit. Of course, if U.S. buying remains strong, then maybe it doesn't matter so much. But those are some of the things guys are talking about. And, of course, country of origin labeling is still out there. I don't think that's an issue that's going to disappear anytime soon.
Just on that, so, you know, cool, there's been a lot of rumors around cool since President Trump was elected in November. How real do you think this is, that we could see a new version of cool emerge sometime in 2017?
Oh, I think everybody's waiting for something to happen. But, Trump seems to be mentioning Justin Trudeau whenever he can. So it seems like there's good relationships developing. So, I think some participants are hoping the Canadian government tries to get in front of this and maybe try and shape a good relationship. But I think there's optimism out there, but I do think most people think something's coming.
Well, thanks, Dave. We'll keep watching Donald Trump and see what impact he has on commodity markets. But thanks again for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Let's do it again.
I've been speaking with Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada. That wraps up another edition of Between the Rows. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Robert Arneson.
We'd like to thank Gowan Canada, our sponsor for today's Between the Rows podcast. Remember, if you have Group 1 or 2 resistant wild oats on your farm, use Avidex or Fortress to control them. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. If you like what you heard on today's show and you want to hear more, go to membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.